Welcome to Season 5 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 108, Apiary. Today, we are joined by Connie Vogelman, the designer of Stonemaier's games, Worms Fan, as well as our spotlight game, Apiary. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, me too, honestly. I thankfully got to get to know you a lot more, so I'm excited for everyone to listen and learn a little from you, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
For anyone who doesn't know you, do you mind going into how you got into designing games?
Yeah, 100%. So I had played games actually from when I was a kid. My family was a big kind of trick-taking. We did a lot of Pinochle, we did a lot of cribbage, we played a lot of games when I was a kid. But then I didn't really do much with it until I went to law school, when I had a friend basically say, you know, would you like to come over for dinner and a board game? And I was like, what? what are we? How old are we? That game was Settlers of Catan, and it absolutely hooked me. And so for the next probably 6 or 7 years, I was just getting more and more and more into the hobby. And then actually my partner, David, one time like woke up and he's like, hey, I had an idea for a game, sort of in a dream. You know, I'm going to try to make it. And I said, okay, cool. That's a really good idea. Let me help you. That was a very short-lived effort. Turns out we don't design well together at all.
Oh, no.
No, that's totally fine. And I think ultimately he kind of decided that he wanted to spend his time elsewhere. But I totally caught the design bug from there. And I was like, this is so amazing. I had never, and you know, this may come to, you know, what we think we can do, but I had never thought of myself as being able to design games. And that was just shortly before I had an idea for Apiary, which sort of centered around what if your workers age and die as a concept. And then I just really ran with it and haven't looked back ever since.
That's so interesting. So were you, when you started thinking about Apiary, aging and dying, were these supposed to be people or was it always bees? I have to ask with that, like, aging and dying.
It did start from Village, the Marcus and Inca brand game from back in the day. And in that game, you basically have a time track. And then every time you basically go around this, do a single loop around the time track, one of your human workers dies. From pretty early on in Apiary, though, it was always going to be bees. And again, to be clear, I was never trying to kill them in the same way that you do with Village. But I just was really fascinated. You know, I had been keeping bees for a little while at that point. My grandfather had always kept bees. And I was just sort of fascinated by this little ecosystem where these workers carry out these different roles over the different courses of their lives. And then they also just have these really designated roles within the hive. But they live such a short period of time, though, like the organism in some ways is the hive itself. And so that was kind of a very fascinating concept. And so that was where the game came from.
No, that is super cool. It's funny, you saying that concept made me think a little of when I had Sarah, who designed Deadly Dowagers, on the game. Because, like, yeah, you're familiar with the concept of, like, oh, we're marrying and then killing off the husbands. And she's like, well, that's not how it actually started. That was just our way of, like, speeding up this concept and mechanic. Well, okay, so you've kind of talked a little about this, but how did you actually mechanically make these workers? Like, how do you play the game?
The way you play the game is, so it's a worker placement game, and in the final production copy, they have these wonderful four-sided workers. And by the way, there were D4s throughout all of playtesting, which was much less cool.
More painful if you step on
them. Right,
right. Like a bee sting.
Right, and you weren't rolling them. But yeah, so there's a number 1 through 4, and so you can basically rotate from a 1 to a 2 to a 3 to a 4, with the idea that every time you use the worker, it will go up 1 in strength, and that the higher the number is, the stronger the action you will take, you know, will be. So started out with the idea that the different numbers were going to be doing different roles in the hive, you know, so you'd have your 1 bees and they'd be nurse bees, and you'd have your 2 bees and they'd be, you know, foragers and stuff like that. And that ended up being way too prescriptive. So we dropped that pretty early on. But the way all of the action spaces work is that the higher the number you have, the stronger the action you can take. Once you place a strength 4 worker, you can do some kind of a super turn, and then the worker, well, now it hibernates. One of the advantages of moving the game to outer space was that the workers could hibernate instead of die, and that becomes both a little area control puzzle and the time track for the game.
That's so interesting. So whose decision was it to make it bees in space?
Yeah, that was Jamie Stegmeyer's idea. So this was after I was chatting with him a little bit about the game. So I had gone to Stonemeyer's Design Day in, I think, 2022, and got to chatting with him after that. And he sort of said, okay, look, I think this game's sort of interesting. It does seem like you still have a bit more work to do on it, but I'm concerned that Honeybuzz just came out, and that's a midweight worker placement game with bees. Would you be willing to kind of put a twist on the theme? And I said, absolutely. I'm a big science fiction fan. And moving it to space actually did help solve a couple of mechanical problems. I was having a really hard time with the explorer mechanism in the game that just wasn't quite working. And also, like, players don't like killing their workers, as a general rule.
Fair.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. You get attached to the little guys. So making that change was very helpful from that thematic standpoint as well. So I was kind of all on board. And then I ended up kind of reskinning the game, working the space theme into the game a little bit. And then at that point in time, that's when Stonemeyer signed it.
How did you get to be a part of his designer day?
Yeah, so this goes back to Tapestry. And keep in mind, I tend to be like a fairly shy person. I don't do this a lot, but I remember when Tapestry first came out, there was a lot of commentary online, and it was a lot of people talking about their first plays and such a faction won, 120 points to 100 points or something like that. And everyone was complaining about balance. And I was a little bit frustrated by it because we had gotten Tapestry really early. We had played it a lot. We had kind of run it through the paces. And I was like, wait, I think a lot of this feedback is not quite right. It's all based on a first play. But, we're scoring 300, 400 points. What's going on here? And so I actually messaged Jamie on BGG, and I just gave him like a 3-page tirade about the discourse around Tapestry. This is what happens when I stay up too late, I guess. And he was basically like, okay, I'm not going to take any of this feedback, but here are some interesting thoughts. I'll add you to my blind playtester network. And so I started doing blind playtesting for Stonemeyer a couple years before, kind of at the same time I started working on Apiary. And then that was how I got plugged into their network and became aware of Design Day, brought Apiary there, and then kind of the rest is history.
Do you like the game? I've actually never played it.
I really enjoy it. It's a really good BGA game. In a lot of ways, I've really, really enjoyed it there because I do think that you can get off to a really early lead or an early deficit in a way that's hard to make up. So if you're playing with people, for a fairly long period of time, it can be frustrating. But I think the combos and a lot of what you're doing is very, very satisfying. It's a very fun puzzle.
So then when you were working on your game, you have like the different hex pieces, you have your like starter boards and stuff. Did that all begin with the bee theme, or did you have to like transition some of that stuff over? Like, what do some of the hexes do? Like, how are you building your engine? Like, could you delve into that a little more?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's 4 different types of hexes that you're buying over the course of Apiary. So you have basically these hive mats, you're building out a hive. There's a tableau building element. One is farms, that's kind of a storage. One of them are your recruit tiles. Those are your kind of ongoing abilities. The idea is they're kind of ambassador bees coming into your hives. You have, your when played tiles that give you basically instant benefits. And then you have your kind of end game scoring. I mean, it's a pretty, pretty common framework. Those, for the most part, were pretty common throughout the design. A couple of the things that we added later on, actually, the farms also actually provide income. So when you retrieve all of your workers, it triggers your farms and it kind of makes that turn a lot more fun. That was a fairly late addition. We also added the hive mats pretty late. So for a really long time, it was just a free form build. So you could kind of build in any direction that you wanted. An early design challenge I ran into, and this is sort of funny, is that for a really long time, you built out your hive and that was your storage. And then when you built other tiles on top of it, that covered up your storage. So there was a sort of push-pull of how much stuff you could store. And it turns out I'm the only one who likes that mechanism. Everyone else hates it.
Oh no.
and also really early on, I had someone actually lock themselves out of the game that way, which is a really good design lesson. Because my first instinct was like, oh God, they played terribly. Like, what were they doing? But it's like, no, like as a designer, you can't design a game where somebody can lock themselves out of the game. So that obviously, that's where the kind of starter storage that's combined with the faction tiles came in. And the final version of the game has something like 20, 22 factions. I can't remember exactly what it is. And those were really intended to be there from the beginning, although I really built them out once the rules were otherwise mostly completed.
And how much development did like Stonemeyer Games do with you? Was it when you were like given a list of, hey, try these changes, and then you did it? Or was it like you passed it off to them? How did that look?
Yeah. So one of the things I absolutely love about working with Stonemeyer is the designer is 100% involved in all of the development. So I never really lost control, quote, of the files, in the sense that, you know, Jamie had a lot of ideas and a lot of suggestions and a lot of try this, what about this? I don't really like how this works. You know, he also has his blind playtester network. And so Apiary went out for, I don't know, 5 or 6 waves of blind playtesting, where you basically send the game out. Lead playtesters learn it from the rulebook. They do a print and play copy. They play it several times, and then they basically give you a report back. So, you know, and then you incorporate the changes and do all of that again. And we did several waves of that. But the really nice thing with working with Stonemaier is I'm the one responsible for making all of the changes. And this was the same way with Wormspan as well. Yeah. I mean, it's the hazards of all of the spans. And as a designer, I really love that, you know, because there's definitely times when I disagree with the publisher, right, where things don't go the way I want them to, or I get, you know, overruled or something like that. But everything that is in those files, I know what's there. And I, you know, agreed to it or signed off on it or whatever. And I think that relationship is really wonderful. I have a very high need for control in my designs. And so I really like being involved all throughout the process.
Now, that's so interesting, because I know some designers, their game will come out and they'll get like a message or something through, I don't know if it's, yeah, Board Game Geek or Facebook or whatever. And a person's like asking like a specific question on the rules. And they're like, oh, I don't know, because like the developer has taken it. It's like not necessarily as much of their game anymore, because maybe right. Some things have changed. Like, I still house rule my eBay game because I didn't do the development. They changed some stuff and I don't really love all of the changes that were done.
Right. And so I think for me, it's a lot of work. I mean, it's obviously, and there's definitely been, there's a time both with Apiary and a time with Wormspan where it's like, oh my God, I'm so sick of this game. If I have to look at this game one more time, if I have to do one more set of edits, I'm going to lose my mind. But even with that caveat in mind, for me and for my own tastes, I'd much prefer to do that. At the same time, though, I've talked with a lot of designers who are just like, no, I'm so sick of this. I do not care if this tile is worth 1 point versus 2 points versus 3 points. That is somebody else's job. I'm done and I'm moving on. And I can totally understand and respect that as well.
I think I kind of fall into that camp. I have too many games that I design that they're also having me develop. And I'm like, oh my God, I have too many things on my plate. It's so hard to keep those juggled. Also, sometimes it's nice to have separate sets of eyes, but it looks like you more have a group of a bunch of people looking at it versus a smaller company that doesn't do the blind playtesting.
Yeah, and I think the blind playtesting is really, really key. I'm so glad to have that network. I mean, I'm so lucky because, you know, again, you know, one of the blind playtesters, for instance, was the one who suggested the hive mats for Apiary, which ended up, I think, being a really good kind of twist on the game. I mean, that was a complete playtester suggestion that I would have never had otherwise. And I think it's easy too. I mean, I'm lucky enough to be in DC and I have a wonderful playtester network, but getting eyes on it from different groups, different types of gamers, something, you know, getting away from the group think of whatever your own personal group meta has become is just incredibly valuable. And it's really tough to do.
I'd agree. Did you end up working on the like Automa part of it?
No. So Stonemaier works with the Automa or Automa Factory. I'm not sure how it's pronounced.
I also don't know.
And they are really responsible for that, which is wonderful because I really just never got into solo games all that much. And so I would be kind of the worst person to try to design a good solo mode.
Dude, I feel the same. I had to play so many solo versions of games to even start to help with a solo game. But even that, I feel like so many people are like, oh, I like the beat the score. And other people are like, oh, I'm totally good if the game feels totally different than the actual base one, where I want it to be as close as possible to the multiplayer experience.
Yep. And I think the way that the Automa Factory has done it is really nice with a lot of their games, because I think they really do simulate another player or other players without a lot of rules overhead. So it's not just a beat your score. I mean, they really do have somebody getting in your way, but it's really in a way that's really easy to adjudicate. So you're not spending a lot of time on you know, your virtual opponent's turns.
Yeah, no, that's also annoying when you're playing a whole other player's turnout. How are you able to keep a game like this put together and not lost? Like, do you do spreadsheets? How do you prototype this? Because I personally, like, Her Story is probably the heaviest game I've worked on. And I look at this and I'm like, oh my God, there's so many hexes with different symbols and different abilities. And then you've got like the cute little bees in the board and oi.
Yeah, well, so this is where I have my embarrassing revelation number one. And this is something I've really, really learned from, but maybe my mistakes will help other players. I did all of Apiary in Microsoft Office, and boy, do I not recommend
what?
That. Yes.
I'm sorry. No, wait. No. That was not the answer I expected.
Yeah, I know. I know. Well, so, you know, I sort of stumbled into this, and I'm not a programmer. You know, I'm an attorney. My day job's an attorney. So, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to use the program I know. Would not recommend. 0 of 10. I guess maybe like 4 of 10 because of the results.
Okay. That's true. You made a thing. It can't be 0.
Yeah, I made a thing and I did work, but I did spend hundreds and hundreds of hours basically going back and forth and back and forth, because every time I had to update a template, I had to update each card you know, in each tile individually. Since then, I've switched over to Nandeck, and so I do everything in Excel. Basically, the way it works on Nandeck is if you have a deck of cards or tiles or whatever, it doesn't really matter what type of component, you set up one template, and then you get that template to pull the data from Excel, including things like icons. So you basically key, you give it kind of a key. So you say, all right, if I want a fiber token, I will put this key into my Excel sheet, and then that will, you know, Nandeck will pull it into its template. And that has been an absolute lifesaver. And I would never, ever, ever recommend designing a game without something like that. I know Component Studio is supposed to be very, very good as well. Nandeck only works on Windows computers, but there's several of these programs now. And I would highly recommend, because just being able to sort and filter your data and do all of the number crunching in Excel, night and day difference.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I use, I mean, essentially Excel, except I do Google Sheets because I do a lot of co-design. So yeah, you can pop in and out of it. And I have the Adobe Suite, but that is significantly more expensive than other people's prototyping. And I have it paid for by work, so I'm lucky there.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason I got started using Nandeck. It's because, like, even when I started in Nandeck, I just wasn't sure where all this game design stuff was going to go. And Nandeck's a free program. I think Component Studio is $10 a month, and then obviously the Adobe programs are more expensive than that. But I would say that whatever, there are lots of viable programs, but the difference between no data merge and data merge is huge.
Oh my God, for real. Doing data merge in InDesign is game changer. Like, I would hate to copy paste all that information.
Well, and just earlier tonight, I was working on a rulebook. I got something wrong on all of my cards. I meant to basically put a data element on one deck, but I accidentally put it on another deck instead. And the way the pieces fit together, I was like, oh no, this is wrong. It probably took me 3 minutes to update both decks accordingly. I mean, at most, because you could basically just change a data string, drag and drop, you know, insert it into the other template, change around like two things to make it all fit, and then regenerate the decks. And that is obviously something that without data merge would have taken all evening.
Oh my God, yes. Agreed. Nope. Highly recommend for any designer that doesn't already do these things. Check it out. It's worth taking the time to get to learn how to do it.
Yes, 100%. And I mean, and I will say, like, as a total non-coder, it did take me a good day or 2 days of struggling with Nandeck and getting really, really frustrated because it was just so foreign to me. And I was watching Ludo Lodge has some really good tutorials. And so I'd listen to 30 seconds of the tutorial, go back and repeat it. Listen to 30 seconds, you know, try to repeat it. And I literally just did that for about 2 days straight. Definitely worth it, but it was pretty frustrating.
No, I could totally see that. And for when you're prototyping your games, how pretty do you make them?
Not pretty.
Yeah.
I definitely go with rapid iteration over anything pretty. I print out pretty much everything on cardstock. I use almost exclusively cardstock and sticker paper. If it needs a backing, you know, if I'm working on something that really needs a backing, I will do sticker paper and then I'll sticker it onto like chipboard. This is always an interesting question. You know, I tend to not really do much by way of art. I'll get some clip art, but I do put a fair bit of time into my icons because I do think that is really key because, you know, you obviously dip in a prototype below a level. Once you dip below a certain level, it interferes with playing to the point where your feedback isn't reliable anymore. But I do really really subscribe to the idea that the more time and effort you put into your prototype, the less likely you are going to want to be to change it, and you are going to have to change it. The last game that I finished was a fairly heavy game, a little bit heavier than Apiary, and I ended up doing 40 or 45 full versions of it, something like that. I started tracking my versions just out of curiosity to see where I ended up, and it was quite a few.
Especially with your game, you have hex tiles. So I'm sure creating those is not the easiest and recreating them was not the easiest.
So yeah, so fun fact though, and this was something that Jamie told me and it blew my mind, was that if you're doing hex tiles, definitely skip cutting the hexes. You can recreate basically the same pattern with offset rectangles. So if you think sort of like a brick wall, so then you only have to cut four pieces, but they're still adjacent to six things. And the rotation is going to be off by like 30 or 60 degrees. So you have to pay attention to that toward the end, but it halves or thirds your prototyping time to just cut squares and then offset them.
Ooh, there you go. Way to go.
Fun little tip that I learned way too late.
Hey, now you can make all the hex space games.
I mean, I love hexagons. So
they are weirdly satisfying. I'm not going to lie.
Yep.
And were there any other things that you learned when you were working on this game?
I think, well, I mean, I learned a lot, really, because this was really a baptism by fire in terms of my game design history.
Yeah.
I will say one of the other really big things that I learned, and I'm still learning, is filtering playtester feedback. When I first started Apiary, I was so bound and determined, because, you know, everyone has gone to one of those playtesting events where you playtest somebody's game, and they do not want any feedback. And you can tell right away that they are not going to pay any attention. And it feels so disrespectful and so frustrating. And it's like, why did I just waste my time? And I was so bound and determined to not be that person that I went so far in the other direction of like, I am going to accept every single piece of feedback that I get. And so there was one time fairly early on when I started trying to turn Apiary into a deck building game. And I got like halfway through a prototype and I was like, wait a second, like, what am I doing here? Like, it's not a deck building game. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And so I think learning how to figure out what feedback to listen to and what to ignore is really key. So that was a process that I definitely started then and I'm still working on.
Yeah. And what made you gravitate towards a more like heavier Euro strategy game versus like, I don't know, doing something simple?
Yeah, I mean, the kind of mid to heavier weight Euro games are very much the games that I enjoy. And so a lot of it was very much just designing what I knew, if that made sense. And, you know, one of the interesting side notes or kind of sort of asides about being a designer is I've actually gotten much more varied in my gaming interests since I've become a designer, which has sort of been a lot of fun because I think for a while, you know, you get into the hobby, you kind of play everything, right? Because you're so excited and there's a million games in the world and you're like, these are all amazing. And then as you keep playing, your interests get narrower and narrower and narrower. And you're like, all right, I only like midweight Euro games between a 2.75 and a 3.25 on the BGG scale. Since I've gotten into design, I think I've actually like rebroadened a lot of my interests, you know, because I started playing more games as a designer to just try to see different mechanisms and different types of games. And all of a sudden I'm like, wait, these are really fun. So that's been a really nice, I don't know, benefit, I guess, of getting into design.
Yeah, no, that's super cool. I know that like I personally challenge myself to play as many new games as I possibly can. And that has for sure made me better.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the things that I hear from designers a lot, and I think this is definitely a pitfall that's easy to fall into, is just not playing published games because it's directly related, right? I mean, anytime you spend playing published games, you're not spending designing and vice versa. And I do think playing all types of games, published games, non-published games, etc., is just so important to kind of staying current in the hobby and sort of seeing what's going on. I mean, again, sometimes you can go to a playtesting event and somebody's playing something and it's like, oh man, this feels, you know, 10 years out of date or something like that. Not to say that that can't be a good thing. But I think if you're going to go in that direction, you should be aware of it.
Oh, totally. I mean, one of the things I hate saying about a prototype I'm playing is I'm so sorry, this game is already there. Like it's already out there and I pull it up and I show it to them and it's like almost exactly a match or like basically a match to the point where it's a little too close.
Yeah, I had that happen to me a couple of years ago with a game that I was working on it and I brought it to PAX Unplugged and somebody, and this was a game and I still rattling in the back of my brain that maybe I can do something with it to further differentiate it. But it was one of these putting numbers in a line game. And the kind of shtick or twist of mine is it wasn't any kind of a normal scale. It was like you'd flip over two adjectives. And so your scale would be like curious to obsequious and you'd be, you know, putting things on a scale, but it's just too close to something like Edo, which is basically doing, you get, you know, an animal and a number, and then you all list out an animal essentially. So if I say elephant, maybe I'm thinking of number 90 or something like that. And then you kind of rearrange, you know, you put them in order. And there's so many of those number on a line games that it's really hard to kind of differentiate.
Yeah, I have one of those too. And how we differentiated it was like we made it balancing, like you're balancing the scales so the numbers are on both sides, and your group goal collectively is to just balance the scale with the different concepts.
Nice, that's fun.
Yeah, so but that was like annoying because so many people were already like, oh, but there's already a ton of these kinds, and it's like, well, this is what makes it different. And like, who knows if it'll end up getting published down the line. Like, we have this awkward dance we're doing with a publisher. Like, are you going to sign or are you going to option? What's going on here? I'm waiting for that ring. Put it on my finger, baby.
Well, and it's so hard to tell, too. I mean, when is a game too close to another game? I saw that I think it's called Foxpaw on BGG, is currently in the process of getting totally review bombed. And I think part of that is because it's just blatantly copying the Harry Potter franchise, like line for line. And some of that has to do with AI art and everything else. You know, obviously that crossed the line of being too close. You know, then again, Finspan obviously just got announced and a lot of folks are really angry about that. And that one's frustrating because that one is an entirely different game with a brand new design team that spent, you know, years working on this game.
I know, it's also like the same company, so it's not like a company ripping off another company.
Well, of course, and Elizabeth is the developer on Finspan as well. And so like it was made with her, you know, sign off and agreement and her assistance. Her name is on the box, you know.
Oh my God. I remember when your game Wormspan came out, like similar, but not as many memes and GIFs came up where it's like, oh my God, it is dragons. And they like drew like little dragons on the birds. And yeah. I was just like, what is going on?
And it's a fine line too, because like some of the memes are really funny. Like I got a really good laugh out of some of them. And then some of it just is a little bit more mean-spirited, and it's always a little bit of a fine line. But if anyone wants to have fun and make, you know, spam memes, like I'm definitely here for it. It's just yeah. Again, as you said, it's the same company, Elizabeth Hargrave's involved. You know, again, it's their different games. They put a lot of time and effort into them, etc.
Totally. Yeah, it's not like they were ripping her off and like fired her and moved on to other designers. It's like, oh no, she's actively a part of this. Like, I play tested Finspan with her, and I play tested it with the designers. Tis annoying. But when you were working on, I guess, were you working on both of those games at the same time, or did you wrap one and then do the other?
Kind of halfway between the two. So it was when Aviary was really in its final stages. I mean, the last couple of waves of playtesting where we were really just working on, you know, balance tweaks and a few things like that, that Jamie basically came to me and said, all right, you know, we're thinking of doing the sequel, but with dragons, you know, would you be willing or interested to design it, you know, pitch it to Elizabeth? And I was like, oh my God, yes. So there was 3 or 4 months of overlap between the two, but they were just in such different stages that it didn't feel like it, if that makes sense. Because I mean, Aviary was like tweaking balances, you know, doing balance tweaks, and Wormspan was trying to come up with a concept.
Those are very different phases. You're not wrong. And how did you come up with the resources that were used in Aviary?
So they started out being, this is sort of winding back a little bit, but pollen and water are obviously a couple of the main resources that bees use. You know, bees actually require a lot of water in their beehives, which isn't something that people think about a lot. They actually, in the summer, have essentially an air conditioning system where they bring in cool water and then basically fan their wings, which is pretty neat. And so I was trying to keep it to things that bees would actually want. Once it got moved to space, I'm trying to remember what the other resource was before it got moved. This is coming back a couple of years. I don't remember what it was, but it changed to fiber at that point because I was like, all right, what's something that bees could use that might provide some kind of like a little bit of like an exoskeleton almost, or might provide a little bit of structure, but you know, something that's kind of plant-based. So that's where the fiber came from. In Aviary, there's 3 basic resources, pollen, fiber, and water. And then there's 2 refined resources, wax and honey. You know, honey obviously was always there. I mean, it's bees. The wax was added a little bit later as well because it felt like the game needed kind of one more thing, you know, one more refined resource to work on. And so that got added fairly late. But that is, I mean, that's an important resource in a beehive. I mean, you know, they are building out, you know, the honeycomb and the storage and everything. So it kind of, I think, fit in pretty well.
I feel like finding what resource works. You did a good job.
So it was kind of a fine line, like how many resources do you want in a game? And it seems like somewhere around 4 or 5 is like often the right number for something that's midweight. I think if you get too many more than that, you're just getting into a really, really heavyweight space.
Oh, totally. And with the different bees, how they have their like different numbers and they're moving in the different areas, would you mind just going through each of the areas on the board in a little more detail?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So this is like a quiz.
No, you gotta remember your own game. Please don't ask me questions about mine.
Yeah, so there's sort of 5 or 6 main actions. The boards are slightly different between the it's double-sided for player count, because one of the mechanisms, and we didn't really talk about this, is bumping. You know, so this is a worker placement game where no space is ever blocked. And so, you know, if I come in with, say, a strength 2 bee, then I can do like a strength 2 action, and then Danielle might come into the space with a 1B, and then she actually could add her workers together so she can do a strength 3 action. And then maybe if a third person comes in, my B will actually get bumped back to me, which is kind of a fun mechanism. Blocking didn't seem very B-like. So anyway, so with that concept in mind, you're sending your bees out to do these different actions. There's an explore action, which is basically the bees go out onto different planets. You're actually sort of terraforming and developing the planets as you go along. You're basically making them stronger. Sort of a grow action, you know, because you're losing your bees, you have to get new workers over the course of the game. And you're also expanding your hive. So there's kind of an action for that. There's some seed cards that we didn't talk about. Those are multi-use cards that give you both instant resources and benefits, and then also endgame scoring, depending on how you want to use those. There are several sort of tile collection areas, basically how you expand your hive. And then the spot that got added the latest, which I think is the most fun, is the dance space. So you can basically teach a dance, which is teaching a new conversion. So, you know, by default in the game, you can turn in certain resources for wax and certain other resources for honey, and it's very expensive to do. As a player, one of your strength for actions is you can set a space so that it does a better conversion, or a conversion that's better for you. And every time another player goes to that space, you get some kind of a benefit. But then also presumably you're setting it up so that whatever resources you're strong in, you can then do more efficient conversions yourself. And so that was kind of one of the really fun spaces that we added pretty late on. But I mean, it's pretty basic. I mean, the depth of the game, I think, is very much in what you do. I mean, it's which tiles you buy, how you position them, can you strategically hibernate your workers at the right time to take a good spot in this hibernation comb, which gives you an instant benefit and area control. And so a lot of it is really that over complexity of actions. You know, one of the key concepts behind Apiary is I wanted everyone to very easily be able to understand what actions they could take and have the depth come in how you, you know, maneuver through those actions.
Yeah, I played this at the gathering last year, and I was so glad it was very well taught to me, because at the time I was like looking and I was like, wait, what am I going to be doing with these bees? And I was like, oh yeah, it totally made sense as they were explaining the different actions. And I really enjoyed the like hibernation comb. I did pretty good down there. I'm also just a fan of anytime someone can put in like these kind of area control mechanics, even though it's not really part of the main game. I like having that as a sub game for scoring for some reason. I don't know why, it satisfies my brain.
Yeah, well, it's funny, things like that, because normally I don't tend to like area control a lot, but I really love it in Apiary. Similarly, I don't tend to love score multipliers a lot, but I actually, lately I've been jamming on fromage. I've played so many games of fromage lately, and my favorite thing to do in fromage is there's this fruit mini game. You know, it's a game of mini games. And my favorite is this fruit mini game that you can make cut fruit and you can make jam, and your score for fruit at the end of the game is your cut fruit times your jam. And that's like pretty much the only thing I do, like all game, every game, because for some reason it's just so satisfying, and because you have these nice little wooden pieces and you can slide them over into the right category and you're like, yeah, now I'm at 3x4, now I'm at 4x4, and it just feels like so satisfying.
Yeah, I just played that game like a few weeks ago and I was like, oh, the Lazy Susan, oh, the little mini
games, so good.
Oh, like bringing back your worker placements when their faces are looking at you, and it's like, I like and love every piece of this, damn it.
I know, it is so dang clever, because it's also such a short game too, because it's all simultaneous play, so yeah, that one has been the one that has hit our table the most, I think, over the last 2 or 3 weeks.
I know. I looked it up and I was like, oh man, it's like, I think I need to buy this. I was like, damn it. That and Last Will, I played both of those games like over the past few weeks, and I was like, damn, these two I keep wanting to buy.
Yeah, I haven't played Last Will in a while, but I had that same reaction. I was like, oh, I really wanted to buy it. And then I think I was saved by it being out of print at the time.
Oh, yeah. See, I found someone who's going to the gathering and they're like, oh, I'll sell it to you, because they just saw me post on Facebook how much I liked it. And they're like, oh, I have a copy, I'll give it to you. And I was like, yes, woo! No one did that for fromage, sadly.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
We live in a fairly small townhouse in D.C. and we finally upgraded from 1 Calyx to 2 Calyx. For a long time, we haven't been very, very aggressive about culling games, but now I'm like, oh my god, we have so many empty cubbies, like what can we possibly do to fill them? So it's pretty exciting.
Uh-oh, you don't fill it immediately?
Not yet, but working on it.
And so I know you're working on like an expansion for Apiary. What's going on with that expansion?
Oh yeah, so the expansion's actually out. It's a very, very small expansion. It's just, we fixed a couple of tiles and factions that we didn't really like how they played, you know, once the game got out into the wild. And then this is dealing with different metas and different playtesting groups. You know, we had a faction that you could basically level down the strength of your workers. You could level them down or level them up. And whenever we playtested it, people would level them up some, they'd level them down some, like it would kind of even out. And then you get playtest groups in the wild that are either only level them up or only level them down. And only leveling them down in particular causes really wild gameplay impacts that we just didn't foresee, which, again, you know, it's a learning experience. But anyway, so we patched up a few things like that. And then it's just a more stuff expansion. We added more hive mats. We actually added different frames so you can expand your hive. And we made all of the frames in the base game were all identical, so you just add a frame to your hive. Now they're different, so you can, you know, choose which one you want that synergizes with your strategies. And then I just added some more tiles, basically more of everything. So it's a pretty very easy, that it adds about 2 or 3 new rules, you know, very minimal impact overhead. And those tend to be the expansions that I like the most. You know, with so many games coming out, I don't know how many times I've bought an expansion, and then that's kind of the kiss of death for actually playing that game, because by the time you have to do a board overlay and swap these cards in and swap these cards out, especially if it's a game that you can't play if you're teaching the game to new players, we find that we just don't play the game anymore. So for this, I wanted it to be plug and play, easy peasy. You can just always teach the game with that expansion.
Yeah, I tend to like expansions where I just can put it in the main game and then forget that it exists. Like, it's just, it is the game now. Or now I can play more players.
Yep, 100%. Yeah, and I think like the Dune Imperium expansion, I'm dating myself now, but the first Dune Imperium expansion of the original Dune Imperium is one of those that I just perpetually leave in. I don't take it out. It's just how the game is.
Yeah. And how long do you think it took from that initial thought of, hey, B game, to having it publicly out and everyone being able to play it?
Yeah, a few years, definitely. I started working on it in early 2019, like pretty early in 2019, worked on it real hard for about a year, then COVID hit. I didn't really do anything with game design for like a year. You know, I was quite in it at that point, and I wasn't really aware of a lot of the online playtesting that was going on. And it was such a weird time, you know, I kept just waiting for things to open up. So kind of took a year off. And then maybe 6 months or so before the Stonemaier Design Day, which was in the fall of 2022, I picked it up again and then really started working on it hard. So I probably worked on it for about a year and a half before I started pitching it. There was just a year and a half gap in the middle. And then between when it was signed and when it was done was another maybe 6-8 months, something like that.
Oh, wow. That's longer than I've been baking games.
It's a slow process. I mean, and that's especially for some of these, well, really for any game. I mean, because, you know, the other thing too that I think a lot of times folks don't know is just how long it takes from when you hit print to when the game actually makes it, you know, back to makes it into people's hands. I mean, that's probably a good 6 months for most games.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Because like digital proofs, that could take up to 2 weeks. And then getting your pre-press copy, you're looking at potentially could be a month, depending like if there's plastics like you guys have, you got to create those molds, you got to prove them and then put them into production. A lot of times they do like 3D printing is their first round. And it's just so many different layers that no one really thinks about.
Yeah. And I mean, as you said, even the proofing, I mean, you know, it's Stonemaier at this point, you know, they have several rounds of proofing, you know, after the graphic design and stuff like that. And I mean, it's a lot of files. I mean, if you think about every data element that's on every single piece of one of these Euro games, it's easy to forget how complicated it is and how many elements are on each and every card that then you have to kind of go through and check.
Oh my God, for real. How did it feel when you found out that Quanchai was going to be doing the art?
Oh my God, amazing.
It sounds like that's like a dream for me. So tell me more.
Oh, well, I wish I could actually, but this was something that Jamie just kind of negotiated and handled. And he was like, he basically asked me, he was like, hey, do you have any artists in mind? If not, I'd really like to reach out to Quanchai. And I was like, yeah. Like, I'm certainly not going to stop you from that. And then, you know, and then it just kind of went from there. And I actually didn't really work with Quanchai. You know, Jamie coordinated all of that. And it's sort of interesting. I think, you know, each artist relationship is just going to be very different. You know, I worked very closely with Clementine, who did Wormspan. But, you know, a lot of that was because it was mostly simultaneous. I mean, she was starting to draw dragons as soon as I was starting to make the game. Whereas Apiary, Quanchai really started after, you know, after the game was done.
Yeah. Oh, so interesting. That's kind of like when I came onto the project of Her Story, a lot of the illustrations and the women in the game were already picked. So it was like, okay.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it was like, all right, making the game.
Was that good or bad or both?
It was cool in the way that, because I actually interviewed to be the female designer of that game.
Okay.
So, And it was funny because like Roberta Taylor and I were apparently up. We were the last two, but she couldn't make the time for it. And so I ended up getting the job. And then she quit her job after. She's like, I'm not letting an opportunity like this slip away.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So it's funny because like the same game affected both of our histories differently.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I know. But I liked it because by looking at the art, I had like an idea. I became a little more inspired of like, hey, where could this game go? Because they had already started working on the game. They were like a third of the way. They had a few different options. And I kind of just like took over and was like, we're doing this and that and this and that. It was like an interesting relay race.
Nice. Yeah.
Whereas like Emerson and then Emerson and Nick and then Nick and I. And then, yeah.
Okay, that's very cool. I didn't know the history. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was... My underdog games were very different experiences than a lot of my other games I've worked on.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing too. I mean, especially with a hobby that's as small as this one, I get the sense that every publisher is just as different than every other. I mean, no two experiences are going to be remotely the same.
Oh, totally. And speaking of experiences, did you have a favorite and a least favorite with this game?
I mean, I think my favorite was just kind of seeing it all come together, which sounds sort of silly, but I just love how the workers age and die, well, age and hibernate and progress through the system. Not die, they don't die.
They don't die, they hibernate, they're fine. Just taking a nap, space nap.
I think the most frustrating was actually some of the mistakes that I made along the way more than anything. I mean, and some of that was just the prototyping, you know, how inefficiently I was doing it. And again, it was a learning process. But I think at that time, I just didn't realize that all these resources, I mean, like, you know, like this podcast or like some of the, you know, the other design groups that are around, I just wasn't aware of them. And so I had to kind of learn a lot of these mistakes myself, which again, it's a good learning experience, but it took a lot of time. And so I kind of wasted a lot of time that wasn't very well spent. I mean, again, like when I was trying to turn it into a deck building game. But I think at the end of the day, I mean, I'm really, really happy with where the game ended up. So there's not a lot I would retcon, you know, in terms of the final product or anything like that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's hard. There's not like a Bible or something. I remember when BGG like website was sent to me for the first time, because I was like, what are these mechanics? Like, I got bullied by a local group when I tried to play games and they were using words that I didn't know. Like, you said that you played trick-taking games growing up. I didn't. I was handed a deck of cards and like, oh, go do a trick-takey. And I was like, what? I was like, I just felt dumb. And I got to make little cards out of it, though. I was like, all right, I'm going to write every mechanic down and like what it is that they do. And I'm going to watch the videos and the most popular ones and teach myself.
Well, that's probably a good way to go about it. But yeah, I remember when I was a freshman in college, I think, I went to my school's chess club and like I knew how to move the pieces around, but I didn't know any strategy. And I just got absolutely demolished in a way where like it was so unfun that I never once thought about going back. You know what I mean? And I think chess is a particularly tough one with matchmaking. I mean, anything that's going to have no randomness like that, that's going to happen. But I can't help but think that like, man, that experience could have been better. And that's something I always think about with different game groups and game design as well, to just try to be as welcoming as possible. Because, you know, the diversity in the industry is a lot bigger than it used to be. But, you know, when I first got into the hobby, I mean, it was very, very few women. Or anyone, you know, of color or anything. I mean, it was just lots of white dudes.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, the nice thing about going to Unpub is every year now I'm seeing more and more women, where I'll look and I'll be like, oh my God, there's like at least one at every table now, where that was not the case. Like, that was one thing I noticed last year. I was like, wait a second. No way. Like, it was such a fun moment. Or at Gen Con when I had to actually wait in the bathroom, like in line, I was like, oh, there's enough women to have a line in the bathroom. This is not something I normally want, but right now I do.
Right, exactly. No, I know what you mean. You know, the one good thing, so I go to a lot of hockey games. The one amazing thing about going to hockey games is the line to the men's restroom is like all the way down the hallway, and the women's, you can just walk right in. And I'm like, yeah, this is great. But I mean, not at like a larger perspective, but in that moment.
Yeah, you're like, yes, being a sports gal worked out for me. Oh, that's so funny. Well, you offered some advice while we were just like talking and stuff on being more efficient, but is there any other kind of piece of advice you'd want to offer to maybe a newbie designer or someone making a game similar to yours?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say a couple things. I think the big one is that be careful of complexity. Complexity tends to get out of control. And so, you know, your game is always a lot more complex than you think it is. And so I think kind of stripping it down is really important. You can always build stuff back later, but then also kind of keeping that core idea in mind. You know, who's the game for? What's the one thing that just, what's your one anchor point, your guiding principle on that game? You know, what is the one non-negotiable piece? And then maybe it will be negotiable later. Maybe that will ultimately come out of the game, but kind of keeping that guiding principle in mind, I think, is really helpful, because otherwise, I think for me, at least, it's really easy to flail around and to just not make a lot of progress, to just make a lot of kind of adjacent changes without actually making forward progress, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And do you have any projects that you're allowed to talk about that are coming out that people should know about?
Unfortunately, there's nothing I can talk about. Like, I'm definitely still designing and I'm very, very excited, but there's really nothing I can talk about right now.
That's fine. Hey, at least there's something in the future that people can look out for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, then for my last question, unrelated to anything we've talked about, if there was a game you could have designed, but you're not the current designer of, what would you have chosen?
Yeah, so this is going to sound a little weird. I listened to your podcast. And so I've given this question a little bit of thought. And this is probably going to sound a little generic or trite, but it's the truth. And that's that I would have wished to have designed something like Just One or No Thanks. Like one of those games that in retrospect is so obvious of like, oh my God, why didn't I think of that? You know, I think, and maybe it's just because I'm a little bit more in the Euro space, that Euros feel in some ways almost easier because, you know, you start with a premise and then you add and you subtract and you add and subtract and it takes shape over time. But I think one of those games is just one simple, single core concept that's brilliant. Like, I want to be the designer of that.
I totally feel that. Yeah. I get very jealous when I see stuff like that. I'm like, damn it. Why?
Like, why couldn't I have been the one to think of that like perfect idea? Because I mean, something like Just One is just absolutely brilliant. I mean, you can teach it to anyone in about 3 seconds. It's so much fun. It's highly replayable. I mean, I've had so many positive memories with my family and with coworkers and stuff like that. I'm like, man, that would be the best.
No, I totally get that. There's times where I'm like, oh, I did work on this fun strategy, but it's like most people are never going to play that. Like, my game Caution Science is definitely everyone's favorite because they can learn immediately.
Oh, and Caution Science is wonderful. It's so much fun.
Oh, thanks. Well, I appreciate everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 108 Apiary. And Connie, I am so glad I got you on the show. And for anyone trying to find you, can you be found online anywhere?
Yeah, so I'm at ConnieVDC on Blue Sky. And that's basically the only place that I will be found at this point on the internet.
Alrighty, cool. And then I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds. You can find me on, I do have an Instagram. I have a Twitter, but I probably will be deleting it soon. I don't really touch it much. And then I also have a Blue Sky under Token Gamer, and that's G-A-Y-M-E-R. Also, I guess I have a website, dmarkcreativegroup.com, if you are interested in that. Well, this was awesome. It was super fun talking space bees.
Yeah, well, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.